This is the Nichols-Patrick Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of August the 15th, 2016. Current Federal Tax Developments, as always, is brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Nichols-Patrick CPA Incorporated. This week, we're going to take a look at seeing if the fish will bite. Some of the issues we're going to look at this week will be some of the following. First, we're going to have an IRS warning regarding a phishing attack that's being aimed at tax professionals, and it's being aimed in a way to make it look like your tax software company is writing to you, so we'll talk about how that goes. We have an additional guidance given from the IRS to agents not to initiate contact via the phone in certain situations. A taxpayer discovered the limitations of a divorce decree when attempting to claim the child tax credit and claiming an exemption for a child when he was a non-custodial parent. A real estate professional also discovers the difference between not automatically passive and materially participating for rental properties. The IRS grants relief to charitable remainder annuity trusts that have had problems due to low interest rates. The tax court looked to form over substance. Now, in the backwards, what we usually say, substance over form, looking at form over substance dominating in a reverse 1031 exchange situation. And the IRS is also giving us guidance on I-10 changes that were imposed by Congress in the PATH bill. So we have all kinds of neat things happening this week. And it's coming to the time of the year when I have a lot of continuing education courses coming up. And we have quite a few I'll be presenting here at the end of August. On the 15th, which is the day this officially goes live, I'll be doing a webcast session and for the Washington Society of CPAs on preparing Form 1041. Then later in the week, I'll go to Columbus, Ohio for the Ohio Societies, and I'll be doing a live and a webcast version of both a fringe benefits course and a course on identity theft information security. On the 22nd of August here in Phoenix, I'll be doing a session for the Arizona Society of CPAs, both live and webcast, on ethics and quality control and tax practice. On the 24th and 25th, I will be heading to Albuquerque, New Mexico for the New Mexico Society of CPAs for a live session at their offices. We'll have first on the 24th, construction contractors, tax and accounting issues. That particular course is 50% tax and 50% accounting. So it's one of those odd half and half days, shall we say. But we'll talk about both sides of the problem there for contractors. And we'll also have a course on the 25th, a new course on corporate taxation. We're going to look at subchapter C in general as it applies to both C and S corporations. So we have a lot of courses coming up. And, you know, if you're going to be in any of those locations, be sure to stop by. You know, if you have an interest in those courses, stop by, take the course. And I hope to see some of you there as we come up in the coming couple of weeks as I end up presenting the courses for the state societies. Well, let's go ahead and take a look at what's actually happening this week now. And first, we're going to start with a warning the IRS put out in news release IR 2016-103. This is a news release issued on the 11th of August, where the IRS warned practitioners about being targeted by emails. These particular emails that are targeting the practitioners were aimed specifically at convincing you that your tax software vendor had an update that you should be applying. They would send you an email, perfectly formatted, looks like it came from your vendor, whoever that vendor may it be CCH, may it be Thompson, may it be Intuit, and it would say, you know, click here and download an update. You'd go to a web page that looks like the tax software company's web page, and you download this supposed update for your tax software. Well, as you might guess, that's not really going to update anything about your tax software. What it will do is put in a keylogger on your machine and send the keystrokes that you're making to this third party. Now, of course, we don't know what the third party is planning to do with those keystrokes, but almost certainly it's nothing very good. The problem we've got here is we're going to see more and more of this happening over the next few months. The third parties who are trying to do tax preparation fraud, and they're probably going to try to get ready over the next few weeks, next few months to hit the next tax season. The IRS is getting better and better at catching these, you know, their scans ahead of time. So one of the things they're looking to do now is to compromise preparers who legitimately file returns. By doing that, they can then craft returns that look like they're legitimate, but have the refund going to these fraudulent preparers. So you need to be very careful and talk to your staff about the problems that we're going to have here. Make sure everybody in your office knows what your update software looks like. For instance, we use CCH Pro System FX. It has its own update software. so that we use that updater to update their materials. Now, the downside is from time to time, they've offered special programs that are used to scan a database. And unfortunately, they've often sent that out with an email saying, you know, go to this link on our website and download it. You got to be really, really careful. It's very easy for the scammers to make an email look totally legitimate. The problem we have is if the context is right, we're getting an email from a company we work with, and what they're asking us to do appears reasonable. They're a software company. They're asking us to do an update. We're likely to do it. Now, you may say, wait, but they don't know I use CCH, or they don't know I use Lacerte, or they don't know I use UltraTax. Well, the problem is there's only a few vendors out there. So if they just blast every CPA address they have an email that claims to come from, pick any one of the three, there's a good chance, you know, that a good chunk of the emails the people get hit are going to say, well, that looks like it because I use this program. So therefore, this must be legit. Again, the context is right. That tells us that there's a real risk that people are going to end up clicking on these emails. And that means that a number of preparers could get compromised. So be very, very careful and don't be surprised to see other ways come up of trying to get you to install things on your system that can be used to compromise your client's data, because that's kind of how all this works. Next up, the IRS has expanded in SBSE memo SBSE 04-0816-0031 issued on August 1st. The IRS has told the agents who are in the payroll tax examination area that they are not to initiate tip audits via the telephone. The IRS has been doing, you know, we've already talked about this in other instances, that the IRS is trying to reduce and greatly eliminate the use of first contact by phone. This is a case of tips. This is where you have restaurants. The IRS is doing an examination of tip income. And in the past, they would tend to contact the restaurant and some of the employees by phone to initiate these programs. Now the IRS, you know, orders on high, we discussed earlier, the IRS now is going to be making initial contact by mail. In fact, the memo states that they have to send a letter and they must wait 14 days after the letter is sent before they can call to talk to a taxpayer about a tip audit, assuming the taxpayer has not already contacted them. The IRS is also making clear in this notice that they are considering other situations that where it could make sense for the service to change their procedures to eliminate the potential for fraud. Obviously, our problem here is it could be third parties, you know, these third party fraudsters who are going to be calling clients saying, wait, we're from the IRS. We need information about whatever it might be. And please send us that. And oh, by the way, if you don't pay us right away, we're going to come and throw you in jail. Actually, I had a client this last week who got one of those calls and panicked on it and at least was sharp enough to call us about what is this. And the answer is, it's nothing. It's a total fraud. And, you know, don't do anything. And certainly don't talk to these people. So you need to be very careful. Watch for that. You need to educate your taxpayers and keep up on how these programs will work. I think it's probably going to be an issue for all of us to have some conversations with our taxpayer about what the normal contact methods should be for initiating an IRS exam and what's not normal. We know it. Problem is, our clients don't. Let's hit our first court case of the week. This is a case of Capel Senior versus Commissioner, Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-150, issued on August 10th. And I took this case this week because I think it's going to be very important for us as we get to our due diligence rules for next year. As you probably are aware, the PATH Act that Congress passed in December is going to require us to police not just the earned income tax credit now, but also any taxpayer who claims a child tax credit or who claims the American Opportunity Tax Credit. One of the key issues for claiming the child tax credit is you got to be able to claim the dependent. And this is a problem here for Mr. Capel. Now, his divorce decree clearly granted him the right to claim the exemption so long as he was current on his child support. Mr. Capel was no question current on his child support. The IRS did not dispute it. The court didn't indicate they didn't believe he was current. The problem, of course, is his ex-spouse claimed the two children on her return and did not give Mr. Capel a Form 8332. This is also, unfortunately, not unusual. Believe it or not, following a divorce, sometimes the parties are not on the best of terms and they get upset and some other slight comes in and suddenly they're just saying, well, I'm not going to sign that for you. Tough luck. You know, you don't deserve this and I don't care what the agreement says. Well, in this case, the taxpayer effectively went to court. The court indicated, yes, they sympathized with him. There's a little question that he should have been able to claim the child, you know, and that his ex-wife should have signed the form. But the fact she didn't means the exemption is gone and so is the credit. The big problem we've got for next year is beginning next year, if you prepare a return under a circumstance like this, and you end up claiming a child and you have not confirmed with the taxpayer they're the custodial parent, but you rather said, no, this is my year to claim the child and I just want, you know, go ahead and claim it because my ex won't. Don't be surprised if you have problems. It's going to be a $510 penalty next year if you allow a taxpayer to claim the child tax credit and the taxpayer is not eligible to claim it unless you can show you did your due diligence. For the child tax credit needing the exemption, it's unfortunately going to be a simple case to ask you a question. Well, where's the 8332? It was supposed to be submitted with the return. Why didn't you submit it? Well, your answer is going to be, you know, well, the taxpayer told me he got him this year. And of course, I didn't think his ex-wife would claim it. Well, nice, but that just isn't going to cut it anymore. You need to be very careful and make sure all your staff understands that the divorce decree itself is not adequate. As the tax courts told us in a couple of cases in the past, what a taxpayer has to do in that case, which may not make economic sense, is to go back to state court and have a state family court order the ex-spouse to sign the form. Yes, they'll probably do it. The problem is, A, finding the ex-spouse to actually get the payment, to actually get them down into court. So we've got to serve them. And they may or may not be in the same state any longer, and we may not know for sure where they are. And then the second problem is just the cost of doing it, because you're going to have to pay for legal counsel, go to court, take time off work, and all the problems. Like it or not, the way this works, you know, Congress made it so that the courts, the federal courts, didn't have to deal with this problem. The catch is your client is the one who has to now deal with it and make it work if they should be getting the exemption. Next up, the case of Gregg versus United States, case number 14-16053 from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, issued on August the 4th. This is an appeal of a district court case from the U.S. District Court of Northern California. In this case, Ms. Gregg was a real estate agent, and she had enough hours as a real estate agent, not surprisingly, to qualify as a real estate professional. All of us should remember, to be a real estate pro, she had to show she had more than 750 hours in real estate trader business. Well, she had more than that just as an agent, and that over half of the hours she materially participated were in real estate activities. She met that as well. The problem that she had was she claimed to get a full deduction for her rental real estate properties. Now, as a real estate professional under 469C7, she is deemed, if you're a real estate professional, it tells us that you no longer have 469C2 apply. C2 says that all rental real estate is all rentals are automatically considered passive. The catch is all the real estate professional does is pull that out of the equation. The fact that you're not automatically passive doesn't mean that the activity itself is not passive. The catch is, it just now becomes like any other activity. Say if your client went out and invested in some sort of candy store and they were the money guy. It's just that same test from material participation. Ms. Gregg did not attempt to document her hours there. In fact, the documentation she had was two pages where they tried to, you know, roughly say, well, this is how many hours we think she would have spent in real estate. That would have been obviously inadequate. But at trial court, she didn't even try to argue material participation. She only tried to argue that at the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals said it's a little too late to talk about that. And so, you know, you bet the whole game on being automatically materially participating, and that simply doesn't happen. Merely being a real estate pro will not allow your client to deduct the real estate rental losses. Rather, the client now just has the opportunity to show that the real estate rental losses are non-passive. And remember, under C7 and under the regulations under C7, which are discussed in the write-up we have for this case, you have to treat just the rental activity as a single activity. You can't lump that with the real estate activity, with her activity as an agent. That's clearly what she wanted to do. But the court said, sorry, you don't get that. You have to treat the real estates as the activity themselves. The Ninth Circuit Court effectively said they looked at the holding of the tax court in the Perez case and said, yeah, we basically agree with that. There's no automatic treatment in this area. You've got to justify material participation. Next up, we have some IRS relief for charitable remainder annuity trust in Revenue Procedure 2016-42. Charitable remainder annuity trust, if you're not aware of those, are one of the split interest trusts that we can have, and we can get a charitable contribution in a charitable remainder annuity trust for having put money into the trust. We get a discounted contribution because the way the charitable remainder annuity trust works is it's going to pay a sum certain to somebody for a period of time. It could be for life or it could be for a period of years. And at the end of that term, or when the person dies, the remaining balance in the charitable in the trust ends up going to a charity. Now, we get an upfront deduction in that case. But here's our problem. The problem we have, of course, is, well, what if your annuity payout, which has to be at least 5% of the original contribution, ends up being greater than what you're earning? Or greater than what you're projected to earn. And you project your earnings under the, you know, under table rates the IRS provides. And with the way interest rates have gone, those table rates are way below 5%. As the IRS notes, if you have a life annuity here, you had to be over, you had to be around 73 years old to get a life annuity and not have the risk of exhaustion rule end up causing your CRT to fail. So now the IRS has put out a brand new set of language. What they're going to allow you to do, and it's a little bit unusual, and you've got to kind of watch at it. They're going to allow you to have language where we're going to do a computation, discounted computation of the remaining principal. And if that computation of the principal ever drops below 10% of the initial value of the trust, and you'll see there's an equation in the write-up. You'll see how this works. And the IRC net is an example we've included in this week's write-up that you can download on the currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com website. If it ever drops below that, the trust will be terminated before it pays out the annuity payment for that year. That allows the taxpayer to set up the CRT, get a life annuity, and so long as they don't actually end up driving it down to that level, they'll be able to keep getting their annuity payments. This is in place now. It's allowed for trusts that are established from this date forward. So if your client wanted to set up one, wanted to use an annuity trust, you may want to take a look at this option because up to now, with the rates being down where they are, it's just virtually been a worthless planning tool, except for somebody who was, you know, basically above 70 plus 80 or so was when you could actually start considering doing a charitable remainder annuity trust. Now annuity trusts are actually more likely to have an option. They'll be available for virtually anybody. Next up, we have a substance where that's how the tax court says it works in the case of the estate of Bartell versus Commissioner 147 TC number 5 issued on August the 10th of 2016. Now, this is a case of a taxpayer who is doing a reverse 1031 exchange. That is, they are acquiring the replacement property before they end up selling the property to be given up. Now, reverse exchanges are allowed. The courts have allowed those, but the regulations don't directly address those. So it had been a facts and circumstances test all along. In 2000, the IRS issued Revenue Procedure 2000-37, and that provided for a safe harbor test. The Revenue Procedure makes it very clear that this is merely a safe harbor. So you could still qualify if you don't meet the test. One of the things which it does impose is the same days requirements that we have for forward exchanges, the traditional where we're using the intermediary. We sell the property, you know, in the name of the intermediary who holds the funds until we get the replacement property purchase. Then the intermediary purchases the replacement property and transfers it to us. Those same time periods would apply, and certain other rules are in place. Well, this particular transaction started before the date that that revenue procedure was issued, and it also ends up being one that would not have met the date limitations anyway. Now, the IRS argued in this case that the way you test this, because now remember we're under facts and circumstances, the IRS said, well, what you have to do here, as is often true, you know, this third party is going to hold the property we've acquired. But in this case, Bartell Drug retained the right to basically construct on the property to build a new drugstore. And Bartell Drug also then, the intermediary, if they hadn't yet, you know, basically sold the property they wanted to get rid of, would end up having to lease the property to Bartell Drug and at lease it at a payment that would go ahead and make any of the payments due on the note. Bartell Drug had to guarantee the note. Bartell Drug had to have the note hold the third party harmless. The IRS said, wait, all the benefits and burdens of ownership are with Bartell Drug. And so what they're really doing is exchanging with themselves, and that won't qualify for 1031 treatment. Now, the tax court agrees that if you're exchanging with yourself, that doesn't qualify. But the court did not agree that we use the benefits and burdens test in a case like this. Rather, the court said, and noting that this appeals to the Ninth Circuit, which has generally allowed a broader test and has rejected the benefits and burdens test, the tax court said, no, in this case, the fact that, in fact, even though all the benefits and burdens were effectively with Bartell Drug, there's a little question that was true. Nevertheless, this was still a valid reverse 1031 exchange. Interesting case. And again, one of the rare cases where we have in the tax court, the case of form over substance is what, you know, form over substance is what rules the day in a 1031 situation. Next up, notice 2016-48, issued on August the 5th. The PATH Act that Congress passed late last year imposed expiration dates on P-10s. If it's not been used in the last 3 years on returns or was issued before 2013, based on a schedule, the P-10 will be expired beginning January 1st of next year. That means if you need to file a tax return with that P-10, you need to go get it reinstated. Notice 2016-48 provides reinstatement. Now, the IRS gives us guidance on how we're going to do that renewal and the consequences of not, which can include losing some tax benefits. They will still process a return if you don't get a renewed I-10, but they're going to tell you you need to file the form. You can file the renewals as of October 1st. As well, the PATH Act had the expiration for the pre-2013 P-10s based on a sliding date scale of when they were first issued. The IRS said, well, you know, a lot of these people who've had them for years will really have no clue what year they were first issued in. So the IRS is going to put up a schedule that is based on the middle two initial, the middle two numbers of the I-10, and will also then send letters to affected taxpayers. If you've told affected taxpayers who had those pre-13 P-10s or I-10s that either they do have theirs that's going to expire and they're going to have to renew immediately, or they were exempt and they could wait, let's say, 3 years or something based on the schedule, you need to go back and tell them, no, it's going to change. The IRS is administering it different. They also told us if we only use this P-10 for 1099 reporting, so we get information return, but we don't have to file a tax return, the fact that the P-10 is expired isn't relevant. The payor will not be penalized for using an expired P-10, and the recipient won't have any problem unless they have to file a tax return, because they only need to get that P-10 reissued or renewed if, in fact, they are going to be filing a tax return or have to file a tax return. So, you know, any clients you have that are involved in that, be sure that you make them aware of how this is going to work. Next up, we have a number of things happening. It was a busy week. The IRS did revise the CPEO, Certified Professional Employer Organization rules, to address a number of concerns of CPAs. Remember, these are going to need audited financial statements and the financial, and they're going to have in the report, the CPA would have to say that they met the working capital requirements. Now, one of the requirements for the CPA in this statement who signed up for it was to attest that they were valid, they were a licensed CPA. You know, they hadn't violated anything. They were independent. But they also had to get a power of attorney so they could represent the client before the IRS. As a number of CPAs pointed out, getting that power of attorney would seriously jeopardize their independence in this case. And obviously, they, you know, if you can't be independent, that's a problem. So the IRS has agreed to remove that requirement from the requirements for CPAs. And when they do the final regulations, they've told us, they expect that rule to be gone. The other issue we had here is they also moved the working capital that they wanted to be in the opinion. And CPA said, well, we can't really do that. That's going to be agreed upon procedures. It's going to be very messy. We're going to have lots of problems if you try to put it there. The IRS is now going to say the financial statements have to address that in the notes. Since this is a voluntary disclosure being made in the notes, the CPA will report on that in their audit report. Also, they will not have to state it is on the accrual basis because, as the IRS became aware, GAAP requires accrual basis and they're asking for GAAP audits. So guess what? These guys are considered to be fine. So some of the problems now, the IRS moved fast to address those. That's the good news for us. Now, if we could just get the people doing mortgage loans to understand the limitations of CPAs, we might actually be in even better shape. Well, this has been the current federal tax developments for this week. And as I note, we've got lots of things happening. And as a CPA, there's a whole lot to keep up with. And, you know, if you really want to serve your clients, your education has to be about more than just doing the minimum to meet the state law. And because of that, you need to be aware of all these areas: taxes, personal financial planning, doing financial statements and reporting on those, working and consulting with small businesses, helping them set up their computer systems, doing payroll. All of these are things for which your state society has continuing education courses that can help you build your skill set. Be sure to check your state society's website for courses that are upcoming and consider signing up for those courses. You know, your clients expect you to be up to date. It's important that you make sure your clients' expectations are being met by you. And that's why it's important to go ahead and make sure you have these courses and you get them set up for you here now as we're getting into the late part of summer. As I said, this is the current federal tax developments. You can catch our daily updates, mainly daily, at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. As things happen, we'll post stories there. You can also download the write-up for all of this week's events from that website. You can also send any questions that you might have to me at edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter at edzollers. And on the website, if you want to be emailed when we post something new, you can go ahead and pick up the emails at that site. We'll look forward to seeing those of you who I may see over the next couple of weeks as I end up going out on the road to do these courses. And we look forward to, regardless, to talking to you about taxes next week on the current federal tax developments.